meow, meow.
This is the Freedom Beat, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus aurelius by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working? Can you feel it? Yeah. This is Lou, and I am broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless igloo somewhere in northern Michigan, somewhere just outside of Bearscat, across the river from Squirrel Attack, Wisconsin, home of the largest rabbit fang, not in captivity. It wouldn't be taken alive. And on the other end of the microphone, we have Monarchist Michael. How you doing, Michael?
Hey, I'm good. Cops' lives matter, man. And the government's great. Yeah, we're the federal fiends tonight.
We changed our mind, man.
All of that anarchy stuff. I mean, it's a neat idea, but it wouldn't really work in real life. So we think everyone should just back the government and salute the flag and go to war and pay their taxes and be a good little soldier for the new world order.
I agree, because if you don't get down with the Constitution, you will wind up a chew toy for the New World Order.
Yes, and on the other side of the pond, we have Divine Right of Rulership Dan. How are you doing, Dan?
Hello, I'm good. I'm very good.
Have you praised the Queen yet today?
I haven't yet, you know. I like to spend a good few hours doing that every day, you know. I don't like to rush it.
Don't you face Buckingham Palace five times a day and genuflect to the Queen? Yeah, good.
That's absolutely right. Correct. Yep. It makes me feel good, you know, knowing that we have that big royal family who are looking after us all up there.
Oh, I do feel better.
Yes. Because you're a bit of a monarchist, Mike.
Yeah. Limited. What's your name, Lou? What is your name tonight?
Oh, Longer Leash Lou.
Longer Leash Lou. There you go.
Yeah. Hey, so Dan, you're like 72 time zones ahead of us. It's like almost Sunday morning there, right?
He's in the 11th dimension.
It's 6 in the morning here, basically. I'm way ahead of you.
Yeah.
I've already done that time thing that you were doing just now. I've been there, man. I've been there.
Okay.
I've moved on.
All right.
What's tomorrow look like?
Pretty much like yesterday, to be honest. As far as
the government's in power and all's well with the world.
Yes, and long may it continue.
Good.
Yes.
Oh, it's not April. It's not April Fool's there anymore. It's April 2nd there. So you're a statist, man.
Does that mean I'm going to get kicked off now?
Yeah, I think I can't do the charade anymore. You got one more, Lou?
Now for our mandatory announcement. Obama is not a liar, he's not a socialist, and his feet don't stink because the Constitution says he has the power to do all sorts of things.
Well, the Constitution also said he's only 3/5 of a president. Too soon?
No, actually, it's probably about 8/10, possibly, because he's half black, half white. So it's not actually 3/5.
In Hawaii.
Okay. But anyway, so, yeah, time zones.
Praise the government.
Yes. Let go. Let gov. But anyway, these time zones. I just recently moved a few weeks ago, and I am rather close to a time zone line now. And it's really kind of interesting because if I'm driving down the highway, I'll get the little message on my cell phone that says I've gone from central time zone to eastern time zone. Would I like to push a button and make changes? And it's really crazy because it's add an hour, gain an hour. And there's a few people I know up here that live on one side of the time zone and then drive to the other. So they got to do this mathematics and leave super early, but they also like get home earlier than when they left their job and all these other
they can work
things.
An 8-hour day in 7 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like voodoo.
Yeah, they're not even using magic government bestowed powers or anything like that. But yeah, interesting. And when I first moved up here, I crossed over the time zone. It's starting to get dark. I'm worrying about unloading the trailer and everything with daylight. And um, I
you know, I'm thinking to myself, oh, okay, cool. You know, I just got an extra hour of time. Hey, wait, that means it's going to get dark an hour earlier. So I was running out of time. And on the good side, I'll have the sun beating through my window at 4:30 in the morning like I did at Porkfest because of being this far east on the time zone.
I don't think you guys have it as bad as we do. I don't know. I could be wrong. But like when it gets to, see, even just talking about like daylight and stuff, when it gets to winter here, I mean, by 5 o'clock in the, like 5 p.m., it's pitch black outside. And it just stays that way till like the next morning, you know. And that's why, what's that called? Seasonal something disorder. It's sad, they call it. Because you have all these people who apparently the darkness affects them so much because they get up and they go to work and it's dark. And then they come home from work and it's dark, and apparently it has a weird psychological effect.
Well, that's more the latitude than the longitude, because the further north that you are, the shorter the days. Like up in Alaska, in the summertime, it's basically daylight 24 hours a day for the most part, and in the wintertime, like was the most northern town or something like that in the world is there, and it's dark for like almost a month.
Oh, man. I can't even imagine.
Matter of fact, there was a very cheesy vampire movie made about it, and it's called 30 Days of Darkness or something like that, or 30 Days of a Really Cheesy Movie.
Was there not a bit in that show 30 Rock when the character Jenna, she was supposed to be like filming a movie in Iceland? And it was like, okay, we've got 1 minute of daylight, let's get this shot. And it's like, only got 1 minute each. It was brilliant, man.
I never really got that much into 30 Rock.
Did you not? Why not?
Oh, no. Well, I haven't owned a TV in probably 4 years, 5 years, something like that. So, yeah, I watch a couple shows online, but that just never really made it. I mean, I've enjoyed it when I did watch it. I just never really got invested in that show.
I quite liked it. I think it's, I don't know, it was my wife that got me into it, Katie. She's got a big thing for Tina Fey. She thinks Tina Fey is hilarious. So it was her that got me into it. But I like it, man. I especially like the character that the Baldwin plays in it.
Jack
Donaghy. He keeps pronouncing it wrong, saying Donaghy. That's a complete mispronunciation of that name. But like he's brilliant because he's like such a sort of like Republican style stereotype, you know, like he's part of the committee to reinvade Vietnam and things like that.
and to top it off, he's like, in real life, he's like a hardcore lefty.
Is he? That doesn't surprise me.
Oh, yeah.
Apart from when he's being rude to pilots.
Yeah, well, rude to just about everybody from what I've, you know, seen in like the tabloids. But
That kind of puts me off actors a bit. I've seen interviews with Steve Martin, and he came across as being quite full of himself and that, and it's really quite arrogant, and it's put me right off him. You know, it's every time that I see something, I don't kind of look at him the same way, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of actors that have been really nasty. I mean, Alec Baldwin has smacked a few people around for taking his picture, Sean Penn. I know a lot of them are just really, really horrible people in real life. They just look at they look at everybody else like peasants and misfits and just, yeah, the lower classes.
As scum.
Yeah. Well, every once in a while, if I'm scrolling through Face Beast, there'll be like some article that pops up saying, you know, these celebrities are the worst tippers, or these celebrities treat the hired help worse than, you know, anybody else. And it's just really, wow. And yeah, they are quite full of themselves. They're not even on like 34 radio stations. So I don't know where they get the idea that they're such like, you know, really cool people.
Well, they're not as famous as all of us.
Right. Exactly. I mean, there's like literally 5 or 6 people who know who I am by radio.
A whole 5 or 6 is probably no one in Scotland who knows that. I don't know how many people here listen.
Well, how big is the liberty movement, the no government man and woman movement over there?
there basically isn't one, to be perfectly honest. You know, there's like a few groups and things like that, but there's no, I mean, someone said it could be described as a circle at best, you know, as opposed to a movement, because you don't really, you don't have it so much. I mean, there was a big thing recently, there was there is a apparently a UK libertarian party, and they were asked to go on the BBC on this politics show, and they refused, and people started really having a go at them for that, you know, because they were saying basically that's a chance to, you know, get some libertarian ideas across on the BBC. But, you know, then there's obviously the other side of that. Are they, would they be putting them on to kind of set them up and make them look daft, if you know what I mean? There's kind of two sides to that.
Yeah, that's kind of strange, because here in America, the Libertarian Party, they clamor for attention so much that they won't refuse anything. Trying to keep them off of radio or TV would be like trying to keep cats off the furniture.
That's funny, because it shows you the kind of the difference. I mean, there's not really, apparently there's, I see things on Facebook about a Scottish Libertarian Party, but I'm not really interested in parties, to be honest. You know, it's, well, obviously. I'm breaking character. I can't do this anymore.
Oh, no, it's cool. It's like Sunday there, so it's no longer April Fool's. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even April Fool's when I signed on here, so I was doing like extra longer leash Lou. So tell me about the Longer Leash Libertarian Party of Scotland, and why is Scotland so socialist?
Oh, that was funny. Actually, I was talking to you the other night, and I liked your answer as to why Scotland was so socialist.
Because it's in Europe.
Yeah.
Everything is socialist there.
I was saying it reminded me of, again, back to TV, that episode of Parks and Recreation when Ron Swanson, the supposed libertarian, is in London, and he's like, the air here just reeks of European socialism. Well, no, we did
that show. National health and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, that's just...
What's that?
I was just going to say, you wouldn't believe here, you know, like, the level to which people, like, sort of rely on the state for, you know, basic things. It's all, there should be a law against that and, you know, this kind of thing. And it's, there's a lot of factors that Katie and I talked about before. Things like, you know, Margaret Thatcher and the poll tax and all those kind of things. That really did hit Scotland, because, I mean, Margaret Thatcher, obviously a Conservative Prime Minister, there used to be a lot of Conservative members of Parliament in Scotland, but now there's only one, and it's an actual fact that there's more giant pandas in Scotland, because there's two, than there is.
All right, we're going to talk more about that when we come back here on The Freedom Fiends. Wimes.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
For some reason in this country, and in a bunch of lesser world, it's okay to just dodge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created Fiend Phone. I'm using Fiend Phone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FiendPhone.com, Foxtrot, Echo, November, phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Dan over in Scotland. Welcome Hello. Back, Dan.
Yes, it's great to be back.
So why is Scotland so socialist? We were chatting about this the other night, just shooting the bull, getting to know each other. And what are some of the status fallacies that exist over in Scotland when it comes to the state? Because, you know, last segment, you're talking about how people are so dependent upon the state and how they would, like, starve to death and die without it if they didn't, you know, do everything and be in charge of everything. So talk about the Scottish statism.
It's particularly bad in Scotland. You know, Scotland always strikes me as, because I have family in England and stuff, and Scotland's always been way more to the left, it seems, you know, the people in general. I mean, even to the point that now, you know, the Scottish National Party, who are basically just... It's funny because they're nationalists and they're also kind of socialists, you know, and not that I'm putting those words together, but, you know, you could describe it that way. But, like, they made the prescriptions here free, you know, like from your doctor and stuff. And if you're not paying any tax and you don't understand economics and or, you know, that's stuff like that seems great. You know, it seems like, oh, I'm getting free prescriptions and then they're going to give me free this and free that. Because that's, I mean, before the Scottish independence referendum, the Scottish National Party were pretty much promising the world to Scotland. You know, it was ludicrous, man, because they seemed to think that somehow the oil ferry was going to appear, you know, and suddenly make us all rich. You know, and there's, I've said it before, there's plenty of countries that have oil, but the people don't exactly have any access to it. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't make everyone rich. And I remember someone said to me, I was talking to this girl and she was really, really pro-yes for the independence referendum, but she's so socialist, and she was like, no, there'll be checks and balances in an independent Scotland and we'll all, like, get some of that oil revenue for us. And I was like, what planet are you living on, man? Are you going to set up an oil rig yourself? You know, it's ridiculous. This is what up against.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. And to be honest with you, I would consider nationalism and socialism to be not entirely different, because they're both collectivist ideologies and this belief that, you know, we're all in this together and all this other nonsense. So, yeah, when you say that there's a socialist group that's nationalist, it's really not a stretch. And no, yeah. I'm not going full Godwin and calling people Nazis. I'm just saying, you know, nationalism and socialism do have a tendency to go together.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would agree. You know, and it's funny. Just I don't always put it that way, but it's the Scottish National Party. I mean, well, I wouldn't say they're like full on socialists. You know, they are. I mean, I suppose you would say they're sort of social democrats, if you want to put it that way. But so I want to be clear, you know, they're not like as bad as, for example, say the Scottish Socialist Party, who used to have four members of parliament in the Scottish Parliament, the Scottish Socialist Party. That was a scary, scary time. But then after a bunch of scandals and stuff, they ended up splitting into two parties and then nobody cared anymore, which was great.
Yeah, if all the parties would split up and become like parties of one and not mess with anybody else, that would be great. I can dig that. But I think this dependency, this belief that the state is responsible for our very existence and they just make us, you know, they just keep us from, like, I don't know, going down the toilet bowl or starving to death or being stranded somewhere without roads. I really think that this comes up in the schools, the indoctrination camps. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the statism around the public schooling, the idea is that, you know, nobody would be able to read or do math or write or just any of this stuff if government didn't provide schools. Mm-hmm. This whole idea that somebody could log on to Khan Academy and get lessons, or that people would learn this stuff on accident, just absolutely befuddles people. And, you know, nobody thinks that's even possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that as well. And I worry about things like homeschooling and that in this country, because it seems like, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's been changed, but the last time I checked, it was still illegal to homeschool in Sweden. You know, like the government actually made it against the law, which is just horrendous. And the problem is,
I think Germany too.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. The thing is, it just seems like I wouldn't be surprised if that, you know, they kind of brought that in here. It just wouldn't surprise me at all, and I'm worried.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
LRN.FM needs your help getting our satellite signal back on in Africa. Our satellite provider had us on at no charge from 2012 through February of this year when they pulled the channel off the air. Now we're trying to raise $22,000 to continue reaching people with the message of liberty in places where it's needed most. Please visit our Indiegogo fundraiser at africa.lrn.fm. Give what you can and share the link with your friends. africa.lrn.fm.
Yeah. Welcome back. This is Lou. And on the other side of the globe, from Socialist Scotland, we have Dan.
Hello.
Hey, how was that for an American accent trying to do a Scottish accent?
It's about average from what I've heard, but to be fair, I stay away from trying to do an American accent. I won't be lured into trying to do that.
Yeah, there's a lot of British actors that play American roles without the British accent, and it's like, if I were a mercantilist, I'd be like, those Brits are stealing work from American actors.
like me stealing work from American talk radio hosts.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have your work permit, Dan?
I don't. It's just as well I don't get paid for this.
Yeah, there could be some American radio host working for free. But yeah, going back to the schools, in Scotland, is homeschooling legal or is it prohibited? What's the story on that?
It's legal just now, but as far as I understand it, there is some hoops you have to jump through if you're doing it. It's legal, like I said, at the moment, but I'm not convinced that it will stay legal for, you know, forever. It just wouldn't surprise me if for some reason they decided that they would come up with some reason. They always do. There's always some, like we talked before about, like, they're licensing like even air guns here in Scotland, and there's always some story about an isolated incident, but look at how terrible this was. And I'm not saying that, you know, some things aren't, but there's always a reason, and it's always for the greater good. You know, you get that feel. I get that from the Scottish government very strongly, that greater good feel, and it just wouldn't surprise me if it, you know, that became a thing in the next few years. You know, because they just, I don't know what it is, but like, I don't know anyone who was homeschooled or anyone who's done homeschooling at all. Out of everyone I know, like family, friends, people I worked with, every single person I know went to a government school, apart from like the few people who went to private schools. But then, as far as I understand, they obviously have to get a curriculum set by the government.
Yeah, the vast majority of my friends home educate their kids, or they even unschool them, you know, just let them go and do what interests them, you know, basically just put stuff in front of them and stay out of the way and let them have at it and chase, you know, what interests them. And these kids are pretty darn smart. But going back to what you said about registering air guns. Now, you're talking about stuff like the little airsoft things, right?
Yeah, like I think you would call them BB guns or something like that. They're just they fire little pellets. And that's,
yeah,
it.
But are you talking about like the plastic pellets or the metal ones?
The metal ones.
Okay. All right. Because you got the airsoft and they shoot these little plastic or foam rubber type little BBs and they sell those in the toy department at like Walmart here.
It shows the difference. And that was a weird bill that they introduced because beside it was more licensing for like lap dancing clubs, you know, strip clubs and things like that here, and it just seems like a kind of odd thing to slip in there, you know, with, because when I read the article about it,
wait a minute, licensing for lap dancing?
Yeah, the more licensing for lap dancing clubs.
Okay. Do the lap dancers themselves have to have licenses? Do they have to do like a driver's test where instead of going around pylons and stuff, they have to navigate the bar and go around drunken patrons? And instead of parallel parking, they, you know, sit on somebody's lap and they get points taken off if like they step on a toe with their stiletto heels or something?
I wouldn't be surprised if that's where it ended up one day. And I'm serious about that. I love how they do this, and a lot of people don't notice, because like the whole article I read about it was about, you know, this some young boy had died in an accident with one of these air guns, and I'm not saying that's not tragic because it is, but it's an isolated incident. And then there's only just this little bit at the bottom about the strip clubs thing, but they make a big deal about all the rest of it. So it's obviously trying to distract you from this, you know, like then it's like, oh, and this boy, you know, well, this happened because of these evil air guns, and oh, by the way, strippers, they're bad too. You know, it's like they just throw that in at the end.
Okay, I thought you were going to say that boy died in a tragic accident with a lap dancer. maybe she was carrying an air gun or something like that. But
she won't be for long.
Yeah, I mean, it is really wild that people overreact, and it's not just a sky thing. This happens here in America, here in the USSA, and people react if somebody dies from some isolated incident, as you put it, and that's what it is. For some reason, there has to be some new law that's going to prohibit something that, one, isn't going to bring back the dead person, and the likelihood of this happening on a regular basis is so slim that there's absolutely no point in doing a law over it, because it's not going to prevent anything. It's going to be like tiger repellent. No, there's no tigers in the city of Detroit. See, the tiger repellent is working.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and it's absolutely. I couldn't agree more, actually. But it's so weird how like it's the thing about the thing about in Scotland particularly is that people want to like believe that this is all good. And when I talk to people about guns, when I say to someone like, "Oh, I'd be in favor of guns being, you know, completely legalized," people go crazy. And they actually somehow think that means I'm pro-violence, you know. That's where they go immediately in their head. That's like position one is you must be pro-violence. And but that's obviously not true at all. Pro-self-defense, it's a completely different thing. But David Cameron, who's the Prime Minister of these British Isles, did say one thing one time that made sense. It was actually after a shooting spree with a real gun in England, and he said, and then people were calling for that, for even tougher gun laws after that, and he said, you can't legislate for someone going crazy. And that's the only thing I've ever agreed with him on.
Yeah. If you look at where the shootings are here in America, like the mass shootings, the movie theaters and stuff like this, it's frequently in these gun-free zones where nobody's allowed to have a firearm at all, which means victim disarmament. And it's also predominantly in these states that have the tougher restrictions on gun ownership to begin with. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you make, you know, never mind that killing people's illegal, but when you make, you know, having defensive weapons illegal or mostly illegal, and you still have this problem, I don't know. Maybe the laws just really aren't doing anything.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's always there should be a law for that. There should be a law for this. And I can't understand why people always want to go there. I mean, I always call it state infantilization, you know, because I know a lot of people who are basically big infants, you know, and the state's like their protector. And these are the very people who want to vote for parties like, you know, the Green Party and the Scottish Socialist Party so they can get more free stuff because, you know, they don't work or pay taxes, so it's just all free to them. And even the people that, like, I know a lot of, on the other side of that coin, I know a lot of sort of middle class people who have a lot of money, and they're very much up for redistribution of wealth. And I don't know what it is, but I was talking to Katie.
Do they support redistributing their own wealth?
Ah, well, there you go. Through taxes and stuff. You know, I mean, I think it's because they want to pay taxes because they want to imagine that that goes to help people, but they just don't want to deal with, you know, poor people by themselves. But Katie thinks there's also like a guilt thing. Like, here, there's a lot of people that have got some money and they're quite happy to, you know, for higher taxation and all these social programs, because at some level they kind of like, it's almost like society makes them feel guilty for, you know, having more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. There was a incident here in the States, oh gosh, probably a couple years ago, something like that. Anyway, this college kid died and he had like $10,000 worth of college loans. And because his mother was the co-signer on these college loans, she still had to pay it back. No. So anyway, 20,000 people signed a petition for this debt to be relieved from the mother who had lost her son. If these lazy scumbag parasites had just contributed 50 cents each, that $10,000 could have been wiped out. Mm-hmm. But no, they had to file a petition sign a petition and ask government to relieve the debt. I mean, 50 mm-hmm. cents.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, I think most people have 50 cents in their cushions of their couches. So, I mean, if you really, I really don't understand how people can say, well, government should do something about this. But with the amount of effort that would be required for these people to do something themselves, it's unbelievable. There's a commercial I saw, and there's like a piece of garbage laying on the sidewalk, and people are standing around in a circle, you know, like somebody had a heart attack or something like that, and they're like, oh my God, somebody should do something. Oh my God, this is a tragedy. And then one person walks up, picks up the piece of paper, throws it in a garbage can, and everybody looks at this person like they have magic powers because they picked up a piece of garbage and threw it in the trash can. And this state infantilization, or as I call it, being a domesticated house pet, it runs rampant. It's all over the place. And I blame the schools for it.
Yeah, well, I suppose that is where it starts, you know, and you do get a lot of, I mean, my mum was a teacher, but she's pretty much retired now. So I don't know. I've not really asked her so much, but maybe I probably should ask her before, you know, she actually does retire, how much of this kind of pro-government sort of stuff is in there, because I don't remember so much. Although I will tell you this, here's this for a weird thing. I remember when I went to a Catholic school. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hey.
I went to a Catholic school, and we were basically, we had to do religious education. It was part of the, you know, curriculum.
But for being Catholic.
Yeah, basically. But then later on, you could choose to do it, and they called it a philosophy when you could pick subjects. So I was interested in philosophy, so I thought, I'll pick that. This sounds quite interesting. So I was in two different classes with two different teachers, right? One class, I was being taught Catholic theology, and another class was all about Marxism.
Ew.
What a combination.
All right, more Freedom Fiends when we come back right after this.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Michael is back with his cat nap. We were the hamsters in his brain for the first hour. What's going on, Michael? You have a nanny story that you would like to share with everybody.
I just wanted to say, even though I'm sick, it's nice to be on radio because I used to, when I was a kid, like, go out in the woods or go out in the country on my own, ride my bike out, outside of town when I was a kid. Like, you know, something now that would, like, get your parents, you know, would get your kids taken away if your parents let you do it. And I'd go sit and kind of, like, contemplate the infinite of the universe and the meaning of life. And I always kind of wanted to, like, talk to a bunch of people at once when I was doing that, but not have to hear what they have to say. And that's, like, what I do every day now. So I dig it. And before that's Dan tells us... No, that's not the nanny story. So before Dan tells us about beer on tap, the beer on tap party in Scotland, I grew up in upstate New York, and the only thing that ever came out of there that anyone's heard of is Welch's Grape Juice, Lucille Ball, and 10,000 Maniacs, Natalie Merchant's band. So I used to go see her band before they were famous. And I remember one time they played in Chautauqua, New York at the Boys and Girls Club, which was like a club for teenagers. You know, it was like a sports club, hangout kind of place. And they played there. 10,000 Maniacs played there. And Natalie Merchant, in the middle of the, between the first and second song, lectured the audience. And she said, and this is the kind of, like, sound she used. And these were not little kids. These weren't, like, six-year-olds. These were, like, you know, 13 to 19-year-olds in the audience. And she said, now, boys and girls, when I was walking outside this gig today, before after sound check, I saw litter on the ground. Now, I grew up summering in Chautauqua, and I never saw litter on the ground. And I know that none of you boys and girls would have dropped litter on the ground here. But, like, looking at everybody, like, I know it was one of you. Nanny Rock. Nanny Rock, man. Natalie Merchant, 10,000 Maniacs. It's the past, but it's the present. Yeah. I think she's one of those, like, get-out-the-vote people. We should have a get-out-the-don't-vote campaign. I'd love to sign up. If you can find one band that anyone's heard of that would do that, it'd be great.
I actually think I'm on the morning of the election here in May.
I don't even know that morning. Man, you're an anarchist.
I can see it. I don't know if that's the day. I think that's the day. I think it's the 7th of May.
It's not the 7th of May. Man, you're many time zones ahead of us.
No, I mean, to the election.
I mean, it's the 7th of May there? April 2nd here.
No, I mean, like, I think I'm on the 7th of May. I think that's when our general election is.
Oh, when you're back on the show?
Yeah, but I think that's the day of our general election here.
Okay, I'm going to go back to the hamster wheels. Tell us about the beer on tap party.
Oh, that was a joke, but I got worried. Now, I was scrolling through one of these Scottish newspapers, and there's a famous Scottish lager that tastes awful called Tennent's. And they were basically, the joke was, like, it was like a thing for your faucet, as you would say, that, you know, would pump Tennent's through the taps and through your sink. And I just thought, I immediately got worried, because I thought, yeah, that's the last thing we need here. Lager coming out of people's taps, man. Bad enough on a Saturday night, never mind, you know, in town, never mind, people with lager coming out their taps. I'm glad it was a joke. I got awfully worried there for a minute.
Well, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. It would be the socialist paradise that you just turn on the faucet and beer comes out. You know, it's like steak dinners fall from the sky and land on your plates because government.
That's what it's like, though, isn't it? You actually use it, like, as a kind of thing, because that's what people sort of expect, you know, here. People just expect that they'll get these, you know, stuff done for them. I know that's obviously a bit of a ridiculous example, like, but I was actually trying to theorise how that would work. And I suppose if you put a keg underneath your sink and then hooked up some kind of hose, I'm not a plumber, you can tell, but I was trying to think of how that would work.
Well, the government needs to dig up the ground and put in a pipeline that brings lager to everybody's house. From the central location, you can put it next to the water processing plant.
Yeah,
all right, sure, we'll be back with the second hour of Freedom Fiends coming up right after this. Worms. We'll be right back.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Re-Education Center's low-orbit ion cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza, on the artificial satellite LibPower 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no-government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. I'm Dan Green, and I'm talking with Lou. Lou, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing groovy. Hey, and a special welcome to our listeners in Sturgis and Belfouche. We're on the morning drive time there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so they're all on their way to work. Well, it broadcasts about 5 in the morning, so they've probably already been at work for a while because they're like hardworking folks up there, and there's a lot of industry happening.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I blame the government schools for all this socialism. And for those of you that didn't hear the first hour, you can go to freedomfiends.com and catch all of our episodes. Catch the first hour if it's not available in your area. And just get, like, all that extra fiendly goodness. But in the first hour, we were talking about why is Scotland so socialist, and also why the USSA is so socialist, and it comes down to the government schools, the state indoctrination camps. I got a little quote here that I'd like to read. It says, if babies were placed into government infant schools from birth, the same government that has convinced the masses that children need public schooling to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic would soon have the public believing that no baby ever learned to walk or talk without their assistance.
That's a good quote.
And when you think about that, that's part of the state infantilization, as you call it, or the domesticated house pet, as I call it. Mm-hmm. And you just have all this horizontal enforcement that you need the government or else you would be, you know, standing in a field eating seeds and weeds and stuff like that. And I'm like, here in American schools, on the very first day, you pledge allegiance to the flag, and I don't know too many kindergartners, and that's about 5 years old, that know what the word allegiance means. They don't know what a republic is, and they really have no idea what's going on, but you have this religious indoctrination where you learn to recite and memorize the prayers, and maybe someday you'll learn what they mean.
Yeah. See, that's something I've noticed about America, kind of in contrast to Scotland, because we don't have anything like a Pledge of Allegiance or anything like that. That doesn't exist in schools here.
No. I'm pretty sure that the USSA is the only country that has a Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Was it not, from what I know about it, there was originally a salute involved with it, wasn't there? And were the people not socialists that came up with it, as far as I understand it?
Yeah, the Pledge of Allegiance was written in the late 1800s by Francis Bellamy, who was a avowed Christian socialist. I believe it was 1898. And the, what was it? Oh, yeah. So being 1898, no, this isn't something that the founding lawyers came up with. This is something that a socialist came up with. And he did it for the purpose of selling flags. So here you have a socialist that is engaged in the market, but he's, I guess it's more fascist because he's using state, he's using the state to ensure that he sells more flags. And the salute was the arm extended, which later became the Hitler salute in Nazi Germany. And a lot of people don't even know that's how people saluted the flag way back when. And then when when Hitler was no longer Man of the Year in Time magazine and no longer beloved by the U.S. government and politicians, and they decided that, oh, well, maybe he's not such a nice guy anymore. That's when they did the crossing of the hand over the chest.
Ah, that's interesting. It's like was there not the thing about the British royal family are actually of some kind of German descent, and they changed their name at some point during one of the, I think it was before or during one of the world wars, didn't they actually look that up? I remember hearing about that. But all those royal families, yep. All these monarchies, and they all intermarry each other. Well, they used to anyway.
Yep.
That's another kind of nonsense that you guys don't have to deal with, you know, because it's terrible here. It's like celebrity culture. I mean, it looked in the 90s like the royal family thing after Princess Diana died. It looked like it was the royal family were becoming deeply unpopular, but they've just gone up and up and up on their rise. And a lot of people I speak to think it's like they don't feel bothered that it's their tax money that's being stolen that's going to pay for all this pomp and finery. They actually think that's a good thing. Just unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, the royals were rather popular here in the States too. When Charles and Diana were getting married, it was all over the news, and people took an interest in it. It had more of a positive opinion, and Diana was rather popular here. I guess she wasn't quite as frumpy as the Queen Mum. So, but yeah, and there is some sort of nostalgia here for that, and I think it's because, and this would also be with the growth of government, because it already existed when people were born. People take it as a granted that that's the way it always was. I mean, for example, here in America, you know, we now have Obamacare, and we're moving into the national healthcare system that Europe and Canada and all these other places have. And there's going to come a time in probably about 20, 30 years when people are going to say, private healthcare, but government has always provided healthcare. Government's always provided free prescriptions and hip replacements, no hip replacements, but plenty of birth control pills and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, well, I think that's what the problem with people here is, and I think that's why, for example, something like the NHS is so, you know, people love it so much. It's because it's been around since 1948, so they don't know any different. So it's just, people can't imagine what a free market in healthcare would look like. I mean, we looked into getting private healthcare, but private healthcare here only comes as a supplement to NHS. Care, basically. I mean, I didn't want to call it care, but you know, if you've been to one of the hospitals here, and I don't get it, man. I mean, like, people have likened it, I mean, all the time in the media here, it gets likened to a national religion. That's how crazy it is. Just unbelievable, man.
Well, with the children in the schools, and I imagine you're younger than I am. I mean, you look younger in your picture. How is the national healthcare system rolled out to kids in school? I mean, do they say, well, prior to the national healthcare system, people were just dropping dead in the streets, and you couldn't go anywhere because there wasn't anybody to come pick up all the dead bodies and everything else. How is it rolled out to the kids there? What sort of propaganda do they use?
See, it's weird because I don't remember that much like being said about it so much in school. I remember it being stronger as more of a social thing in terms of the NHS. You know, it's like people have this sort of, it's like, for example, I've heard people talk about moving, I heard someone who was going to emigrate to the US, and one of the big reasons why they didn't go was because they wouldn't have a national healthcare system, if you can believe that. That's how deep it is here. I don't remember it, like I said, in school being talked about that much, but I've seen, how many documentaries have I seen that have been on television here that have been like what you said? They say, well, what was healthcare like in Victorian England? It was terrible. It's just as well we have a national health service now, you know, and then look at how disgusting this was, you know, as if it would go back to that if we got rid of the NHS. You know, that's kind of the way some of these things are presented. Like I said, I don't remember in school, but socially it's very, very strong here. I mean, you can't be a party and not pander to the NHS thing here. You just can't do it.
Because, how about the Scottish Libertarian Party?
Well, I don't know if they're an actual party or if they're just kind of forming. I don't think they're very big, to be honest. They have a Facebook presence, but I don't really... I've been in contact with like maybe one or two of the guys from it, but I don't know a lot about it. I'm suspicious of anything that's got the word party in it, personally. As I think everyone should be.
Do they run candidates in the elections?
No, nothing like that. I think there was someone trying to run libertarian in England somewhere who was trying to raise money and stuff to do it. I mean, there's not enough backing. I mean, some libertarians got excited about UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, but because when they started, they were kind of libertarianish, but they're just kind of more conservative, and now they're trying to appeal to people who were kind of old socialists who used to vote Labour and stuff as well, so like sort of disaffected mainstream voters. So now they're pandering to the National Health Service as well, when, you know, only a few years ago I heard their leader Nigel Farage say on a BBC TV programme, you know, he said, I think we should start moving towards a US, you know, a US style insurance-based system. But now, you won't hear him say that now. That's very much, now that they've got a chance of getting a few members of parliament in, that's not the case anymore. Now it's a strong NHS for the great British people and all this kind of thing.
So it's just like they're kind of like the American Republican Party then. Basically, the Democrats come up with all the welfare social programs, and then the Republicans conserve all of the welfare social programs. They conserve and strengthen them.
That's basically what happens between, you know, the Labour and Conservative governments here. You know, you can't put a cigarette paper between them. It's just, they're just all the same, you know, and even like... It showed you were all the same, because when we had a hung parliament here and we had to, then those three parties had to form a coalition, and the so-called Liberal Democrats, who are supposedly a left, you know, a quite left-wing party, then suddenly get together with the Conservatives, who are supposedly a right-wing party. But then you realise that they're not in the wings at all. They're all just standing in the middle beside each other. And then everyone on the benches across from them are pretty much, you know, on the stuff that matters, foreign policy and things like this, you know, welfare spending, taxation, the stuff that really matters, they all have the same thoughts. So, you know, that's why I don't even think there's... any point in even engaging with it anymore once you understand that.
Yeah, there's no wings, just a scavenging bird. Yeah, the new American bird is going to be the seagull, because it's a scavenger and it'll steal french fries from a child's hand if given the opportunity.
Oh man.
So, but I think back to when I was in school and the indoctrination that we got, and this was in the 70s, and I'll finish this when we come back on the other side. Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Freedom Fiends, Freedom Fiends, Freedom Fiends, Freedom Fiends. Fiends.
Federal Fiends.
Yeah.
I can't keep that up.
So what's up, Lou?
Please, sir, may I have another?
Yeah, I have no idea what's up. The internets are acting up, or the computers, something. I don't know. But anyway, I'm back.
Well, LRN was down, but I called Ian, and he threw another hamster on the fire, and now it's back up.
Yeah, I don't know if there's something wrong with my computer. I put a energy pellet in the hamster your cage, and now the hamster's running again. So
yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to leave you two. I'll be monitoring your transmissions. Have fun.
Thank you, Mr. NSA.
What was it you were saying, Lou? Because obviously I couldn't really hear you. So I think you were talking about child labor laws or something.
Okay, I was talking about laws.
All right, cool. Tell me about it.
Yeah, the child labor laws here in the USA. They started out with they said, we can't have these kids working because that's mean and nasty. And they never looked at the reasons why children were working in the first place. And it was because it was an actual necessity. But anyway, when the child labor laws really went into effect here in the state, there were it was about 6% of the population under the age of 16 that was working. And of that 6%, the vast majority of them were working in agriculture on the family farms. So government passed a law and took credit for something that was already happening on its own.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's an interesting point in that as well, because you can look at child labor laws two ways. I mean, you can look at them like, you know, kids working in factories, or you can look at them as, you know, you could be, I remember growing up, we used to go on holidays, my family was Irish, and a lot of, like, people who ran the pubs often would have their kids in helping them behind the bar and things, you know, but, like, technically it would be illegal, if you know what I mean.
Right, but... Well, and also you have to look at the mentality behind it, because you got the socialist idea that, oh my God, parents are making their kids work because they're mean and they hate their guts. And everybody knows that a, like, 10-year-old is useless when it comes to actual hard physical labor, like working in a coal mine and putting engines into an automobile. You know, I mean, heaven forbid that you should pick a 10-year-old over a fully matured, physically fit adult for doing heavy labor.
Yeah.
But the idea is that people will hire children because it's so much cheaper. They can hire these useless creatures for just pennies. And there was a incident in Bangladesh a few years back, probably, I think it was in the mid-90s. Anyway, the group Oxfam got all fired up because there were kids involved in labor over there. And it was out of necessity because they're so darn poor over there that they need the income from what the kids can do in order to survive. But anyway, they passed these labor laws passed in the Bangladesh government. And because kids couldn't work in the factories anymore, it was being enforced. A lot of parents wound up selling their kids into sex slavery.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so they don't econ 101. And to their credit, for once, you know, one of these groups actually, you know, admitted that they screwed up by pushing for these labor laws. I don't know if they ever pushed to have them repealed when they realized what happened, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, it's just really crazy. And
so it's the destructive side, doesn't it?
Yeah. But if you listen to the government schools here, they'll tell you, you know, the reason that you're not working in a coal mine, you little kindergartners, is because the government stepped in and said that you need to get educated to learn and read and write and pledge allegiance to the flag.
Yeah, it's a good point. And like I was kind of saying a bit there in the last segment, we kind of lost each other. I hear a lot of people who are like, particularly people who are quite, you know, like communist or very socialist, and people as well that are involved in trade unionism and things like that. You know, not that I'm completely against, you know, all forms of people getting together and organizing. I'm against it being in politics, but they all talk as if, like, the, you know, like, it's still Marx's time, you know, as if it's still, you know, kids and, you know, factories and stuff and up chimneys and all this kind of thing. They still talk about, you know, like people, like they do this capitalists, these owners, as if they're some completely different creature altogether, you know, and then we're just these lonely, these lowly sort of factory workers, as if it's just that simple. And I don't know if you find that hearing people in the US, but I find that all the time they keep talking, they always talk about worker relations as if we're still back in Victorian times, you know, and it's not relevant anymore.
Yeah, you'll get a lot of that here in the States. The hardcore union people talk about how it was the unions that created the middle class, because prior to, you know, the unions getting in there, the greedy capitalist pigs were selling everything for $1 trillion apiece, but they were only paying people like one penny a year, which meant that people had to save up for $1 trillion just to buy a single thing. And nothing got sold because nobody had the money to purchase it. And yeah, it's absolute nonsense. It's, yeah, just nonsense.
Yeah, I find that, and I don't understand why, you know, they still look at it that way, you know. I mean, it's as if like, you know, we're not all capitalists in one way or another, you know. And because, I mean, when you think about it, we're all selling something, we're all selling our labor and things like that. You actually sent me an article, and it was weird because it was January, wasn't it, in the Washington Post?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was about these protesters. One of them was, I believe, she called herself a feminist Marxist. Oh, that sounds scary to me.
The title of this article is called "The Protesters Who Are Trying to Upend the Fantasy World of Economics," and this is from the Washington Post, the Beltway Pravda. And I guess there was a economics convention or discussion group in Boston. It says here, on Friday, on the eve of the annual meeting of the American Economic Association in Boston, attended by many of the top economists in the United States, the agents of the heterodoxy had come to declare war on the profession. The small group threw their messages on the side of the Sheraton Boston in glowing 6-foot-tall letters. Before economics can progress, it must abandon its suicidal formalism. And when I first saw the headline of this article, I was really excited. I'm like, hey, yeah, some young people are getting it. And, you know, they're going out there and they're heckling economists. And usually, you know, when economists and other eggheads are getting heckled, it's by, like, athletes and jocks. And they're going in giving people wedgies and stuff like this. And I thought, oh, yeah, this is going to be great. And I read it, and I come to this part. Harrington, a community organizer and videographer. Well, I hear community organizer, that's one of my dog whistles. But anyway.
Is that like a red flag?
Yeah. Once worked as a climate change activist, dog whistle number two. But after a few years, he came to see the real fight was elsewhere. The type of activism we were doing around climate was running the systemic challenges, he said. We couldn't get the types of climate change policies we need without system change, without addressing questions in economics like growth and limits to growth. So I hear that and I'm like, my God, this is probably going to go down the wrong road. And as I read on, you know, it was, you know.
it does go down the wrong road.
Yeah.
I got really bad. I mean, some of the things I was looking about was just, it was kind of weird. Like, she was there was like 9 protesters or something. So it made it sound bigger than it was. But like they started talking about Buddhist economics, and I hadn't really heard the term Buddhist economics before. That was a new one for me. I had to get on the Wikipedia to find out what that was. And it just sounds a bit like socialism to me, to be honest. You know?
Oh, it's not kind of like socialism. It is socialism. What you're talking about with the Buddhist economics. The quote in here is: "There's a sort of value judgment to the way economics is taught," added Aparna Gopalan, a sophomore at Connecticut College. She recommended a book on Buddhist economics, which is nothing like the Austrian school, by the way. "From that point of view, the GDP is so funny," she said. "It makes no sense. It's like they're measuring how many commodities are bought and sold in a year, but the point isn't the commodities, you know. It's the hours of labor."
It's just the labor theory of value, isn't it?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, that's how it sounds to me, you know. And yeah, I saw this, and who's the other one? There was another quote, and it was someone who, this Fuller person, I can't remember her first name, but she said that mainstream economics doesn't do a good enough job incorporating perspectives on gender and class. I'm not even sure what she means by that.
Well, everybody knows that economics is like, I don't know, misogynistic or something like that.
Apparently.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really crazy with all this stuff in there. And when you look at economics, I mean, economics, of course, is human action, but the economics transaction is people getting together and they're exchanging goods and services for money, or maybe they're even bartering or something like that. And all this social stuff about, you know, well, how does this affect women? Well, it's not about how economic transactions affect women. It's how it affects people that are in the market. And if you and I engage in a transaction, you know, it doesn't matter what our gender is, what our nationality or anything like that. It just matters that one of us gave somebody, or one of us gave the other what he wanted, and, you know, got something in return for it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just don't understand these people. Like, I think as well, like, I don't know if you find this yourself, but I find it all the time. It's like, when you bring economics into something, everyone, like, especially when it's like we were talking earlier in the first hour, particularly about how people in Scotland love what they think is free stuff from the government. And it's funny when you bring this stuff, you bring economics up to them, and suddenly you're the bad one.
Yep. I blame the government schools.
Yes, we don't get to it properly.
And we'll blame the schools some more when we come back right after this.
Worms.
Worms!
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Hey, this is Squisscar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to The Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
This is the Freedom Fiends, Dan Green. I believe I'm talking to Lou. Lou, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Awesome. So we're going to do some redemption in the third act then, aren't we? I had a thought on this Buddhist economics thing that I kind of wanted to share, actually, because, like, Buddhism as like a spiritual discipline is quite individualistic, if you know what I mean. It's all about you, like you're in charge of your own spiritual enlightenment. You know, I believe it's Buddha said there may be gods, but they can't help you. You know, and the whole idea is that you have to do it yourself, and no one else can do it for you. But then I read about this Buddhist economics thing, and it sounds like the complete opposite. Like, it sounds completely, you know, collectivist and less individualistic than how I understand Buddhism to be, do you know?
Yeah, I haven't read too much about Buddhist economics, so I really don't have a strong opinion on it. The collectivism idea, I guess the best way to put this is, if I need to move a couch from like one side of the house to the other, or from one house to another, it's probably a good idea if I have one other person help me. But when you get into the collectivist idea, I should have 60 people trying to move this couch, and you have like a rugby scrum that is gathered around this couch, and everybody's trying to get like one finger on the couch so that they can move it, and you got this big giant cluster bleep, and the couch winds up never getting moved because people are like, you know, everybody's trying to touch it and do their fair share of the work, and so yeah, it's nonsense. I have no idea if that was a rational thought, but you know, we'll let it fly.
Yeah, and you know, you find collectivism all over the place, don't you? And it is really, really strong here, and even within, like, you know, football teams, because you know, football teams here bring, you know, religion and politics and things, you know. They drag it all along with them, and it's that's what I think. That's why you have all these different kinds of people here, you know. And a lot of it's so funny that a lot of people really the whole way they have, they don't think about their politics, they don't think about economics or things like that. A lot of them don't even think about the religion or anything like that. It's just, well, this is what everyone around me does. You know, I'm part of this group, so I just act like this group because that's what this group does. And I find that very, very strongly here. You know, you can kind of separate different types of people here. You know, you could, like, that's quite, it's so strange to watch. It's almost like they're just, it's like they're programmed to believe that what's around them, like, don't question what's around you, man. Don't go out of there because this is fine, you know. And I think it's a comfort thing probably as well, to be honest.
And you have to love this football team because you live in proximity to their stadium.
I know. It's crazy, yeah, isn't it?
It's really funny that people are fans of sports teams because of geographic location. Now, it might have absolutely nothing to do with if the team is any good, which would explain like the Chicago Cubs and Detroit Lions and a number of other teams. But people have this loyalty, and it's based simply upon the fact that they live nearby there, or is the fact that that's the way it's always been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see that here. I mean, here are the sort of two big teams in Glasgow, so it's more pronounced the divide, if you know what I mean, between different kinds of people. And then, you know, into this, I mean, we're talking about football here, as what I'm talking about is what you would call soccer. And just, it's so strange to me how they have to bring in, like, you know, religion and politics. I mean, all at football grounds, they've had to ban people singing, you know, either pro-IRA songs or pro-UVF songs. I mean, what has the situation of a, like, Ireland divided got to do with a soccer game? You know, nothing.
Yeah, well, I mean, people, I don't even know how to explain it. People get weird thoughts, and I blame the government schools.
Yeah, me too, Lou. Let's just blame the government schools.
Yeah. So, it was a pleasure doing the show with you. First time doing a show together.
Yes. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, for more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com.
Yes.
Get your inoculation from indoctrination.
You can find me at greeningoutpodcast.com as well.
Yeah. And so, I think we've answered why the world is so socialist.
By the world.
Yeah, not just Scotland, the whole world. Is Michael there?
Worms. Worms, worms.
Worms.
Worms. Good show, guys.
Thank you for your service, Michael.
I'm the second board op.